Welcome to FSHD Straight Talk, the podcast where we dive deep into living with FSHD. I'm your host, Tim Hollenbach, and I'm on the journey with you. Having FSHD, I understand the challenges it brings to patients and their families. We're in this together, and this podcast is a space where we swap stories, share advice, and talk to experts to get the latest news. There's plenty to say about living with FSH muscular dystrophy, so let's get straight to it. Welcome to FSHD Straight Talk. I'm your host, Tim Hollenbach. Thanks for being here on yet another episode that we bring to you. You can reach out to the show here at FSHD Radio at FSHDSociety.org. This show is, of course, supported by the FSHD Society, the great people there helping with guests and editing and so forth, doing all the back work that you don't see. There's a lot of it to be done. And I always thank them for their support, as well as your support, the listeners and those that watch as well on YouTube, or if it's in your favorite podcast place like Spotify, where I find mine. We are hopefully everywhere that you can find us. Make sure you like, share like crazy, send it out even beyond the community. It would be fantastic. I think more people have to know about this podcast, not because they want to hear my voice, but because of the guests that we bring in. And today is going to be one of those phenomenal guests. If you're a parent of someone that has FSHD, or if you can visualize, if you were a parent of someone that has FSHD, what would you do in that moment of diagnosis as you search for what this could be? And then hearing the words that you could barely pronounce, you know, sliced up into just simple letters, FSHD, now what? How are you moving forward? What are you going to do? What's your action plan? At some point, most people come to grips with what that is. Our guest today, Dr. Ray Hummel, has come to that point in his life many years ago, where not just his daughter, but also son diagnosed with FSHD. Now they are of adult age, and 20 years fast forward, he is deep in the trenches and has been for a long time of rare disease and FSHD, and his knowledge is unbelievable of this space. And we bring him in today. That is our guest today, is Ray Hummel. And he is just a library of knowledge. We cover things from the FSHD itself, being a parent of someone that has FSHD. We talk about early chapter development of FSHD Society in North Carolina that he was involved with. We talk about the work that he is and currently been doing and has been doing. We touch on clinical trials. We touch on things that are down the pipeline right now or in the pipeline, the hope that is coming. This is, I hope, a hopeful episode for you. And I'm not talking about false hope. I've said it before. Hope can be dangerous. You can build yourself up to this hope that something will be, and then when it's not, now what? I don't think it's that kind of episode. I think Ray is really spot on in his analysis of where we are and what he sees is coming. His perspective is not just here in the States, but global. And we talk about that and so many other things that we cover, including mental health, DEI, and so forth. So a lot of things we go through, a lot of things we cover. So without further ado, I want to bring the episode, the interview to you right now. And this is our conversation with Ray Hummel. Hi, everyone. I've got some exciting news for you from the FSHD community. If you've ever felt the unpredictability of FSHD, or wish there was more accurate research and information out there, and I know you have, then listen up. I'm thrilled to tell you about Better Life FSHD, a groundbreaking new research platform from the FSHD Society that's changing the game for those of us living with FSHD. Better Life is your one-stop hub for tracking symptoms, accessing personalized resources like articles and videos relevant to you. And the best part, as you take surveys and track your symptoms, you provide FSHD researchers with better data to understand this complex, understudied disease. And a better understanding can lead to faster treatments, something every one of us can get behind. So head over to betterlifefshd.org and join the study. It only takes a minute to get signed up. Together, we can change the future for everyone affected by FSHD. I've done this. It's a simple process. I challenge you to do the same. Again, that's betterlifefshd.org. Now let's get back to the show. As promised, the interview here with Raymond Hummel, or Ray. I'm not sure how you'd rather be addressed, sir, but thank you for being here. Thanks to you for coming on the show. It's been quite a while since we've had a representation of your family on the episodes. I think it was way back in episode 30 when it was called the FSHD Society Radio Show. And we had your daughter on and so forth. And you've been a very active person within the FSHD community and other rare disease community. So thanks for taking some time out of your schedule to kind of sit with us and like unpack a lot of the things that you do and some maybe great advice you can give people too. So thanks for being here.
Well, thanks, Tim. It's an honor to be here. I appreciated the opportunity that you afforded my daughter years ago. And she spoke so highly of the show and things like that, that I consider it an honor to be here as well.
Excellent. Well, I'm good. I mean, it's great. I don't want to scare people away, right? Because if I ever ask her back, you know, I know that her life has moved forward quite a bit. And before we hit record, you said that she's engaged. Is that right? She's engaged?
That's correct. Well, no, she's actually married.
He is married now. Yeah, okay, okay, okay.
She's married to a Belgian. So she's,
Well, we can't hold that against her. That's okay. Well, congratulations to her. That is fantastic. That is fantastic.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's
great. It's a great thing for the whole family. He's a great guy.
You know, that's all we want, right? For our children. Like, can you just find a good person, you know, and then hopefully from there, everything will kind of work itself out. So that's great. That's fantastic. I'm glad that she's on that great relationship path. That is fantastic.
Absolutely. It's like a blessing.
Yeah. So is that where FSHD being involved in this community, is that one of the main reasons, if not the reason, because it's impacted your family to that extent?
Yeah, I don't think anybody willingly goes into the rare disease space, and I think I'm part of that community. But yeah. When my daughter was first diagnosed over 20 years ago, I found myself quickly scrambling to look up everything I could online. Now, you know, I'm a veterinarian by training, so I know how to do like the science part of things, but the emotive thing after you get a clinical diagnosis of FSHD was, you know, I wasn't sure what exactly to expect because I'd never heard of it before, much less pronounce it quickly, you know, like, you know, so the full spelled out name. So, you know, one of my first go-tos was the FSHD Society. And at the time, Carol Perez was answering the phone, the mother of Dan Perez, who started that, was really, I would consider the founder of it or co-founder. And she gave me some really great advice. So she was a real blessing to our family because she gave me some advice and some practical things that she had learned over the years of coping and dealing with FSHD that was really helpful and also gave us some hope.
Mm. Yeah. So then you go to the Wayback Machine in the early days then of FSHD Society and almost how that was being built and created to some degree, right? To compared to where it is now, you know, what's your observation of the growth of just that, of the FSHD Society?
So 20 years ago, there was not a molecular diagnosis that could be had. So my daughter actually was misdiagnosed, which is common in the muscular dystrophy space for a person to be misdiagnosed a couple of times. And it was a couple of year journey until she finally was diagnosed at a local hospital here in North Carolina, one of the leading ones. And so once we got an accurate diagnosis and thinking and told genetic wise that it was only a 50% chance after my daughter was diagnosed, I was hoping my son was in the 50% that wasn't diagnosed, but unfortunately he was also diagnosed with FSHD as well. So I have two kids. Mm-hmm. And that's what propelled me to learn everything I could about it in my spare time. And it didn't take very long to learn everything there was about it because there was one book out on the time. And I have seen the FSHD Society grow to now we have multiple candidates in the clinic. We had one, unfortunately, recently get to a late stage and unfortunately failed to show efficacy versus its comparator. But the fact that we have multiple candidates in the pipeline, we now have a mechanism of action because we have a proposed target to go after, the DUX4, and trying to suppress that. And more and more people are interested. And the FSHD Society, under the latest leadership, has really grown. And they've gotten a lot more funding. And they're doing things very smart. And they listen to the community, not only the industry and drug community, but the caregiver and patient community.
You kind of have to have both. Or you mentioned, you know, listening to both sides of this, the patient, the care community, et cetera, but also the pharmaceutical side of things. I mean, they are in it for the business. And there's no question. I don't think there's anything wrong with that because that helps fuel, hopefully, a treatment, cure, and so forth. So where do you fit then within the role of what you're doing now? You know, you mentioned you had a more of a veterinarian background, but you're pretty highly involved now in rare disease field. So
I'm
that was
all in now,
fortunate.
Tim. Yeah, I'm all in. I've been working in the human health space for more than 30 years, so my personal life has collided with my professional life. And when it was really clear to me is so I'll tell you what happened. I was running a biosimilar group for a large contract research organization, and I started working more and more and providing insights to the muscular dystrophy community because we were getting more and more requests for proposals from, say, Duchenne, which is was a little bit ahead of the FSHD curve as far as muscular communities and as far as sophistication. So I was learning from them as we went along. I mean, they were one of the only groups. It was Parent Project Muscular Dystrophy, led by Pat Furlong and her team, that promulgated the only FDA guidance for muscular dystrophy, and that was for DMD and Becker back in 2014. Things have progressed a lot since then. But now that there's more and more capital being infused into the FSHD community, I'm convinced that there will be a disease modifying candidate, or hopefully there'll be a disease modifying candidate soon, like within the next 5 years or so.
Wow. Well, that's promising because that kind of is also a good segue a little bit, because that's what this podcast is about the community. And I try to get into the minds of the person listening and think to themselves, what would they want to ask Ray Hummel right now? And I think those are one of the definitely the questions of what do you know about what is in the pipeline? What can you share about what do you think has the most hope? You mentioned hopefully 5 years or give or take, that would be fantastic. Everyone is always ultra focused on a timeline. And then sometimes that's like too ultra focused. There's also the process within it. So I guess the biggest question to me is, and if I was someone listening to this for the first time, it's like, what do you think is the most promising that you are aware of, drug development, treatment, et cetera, coming down the pipeline now?
Yeah, so that's a difficult question to answer, but that is the one that's on a lot of people's minds. So, when I was getting into this with and talking about my daughter, we wrote a book, a Springer book on muscular dystrophies, and really the only action in the pharmaceutical community was in the myotonic, Duchenne, and FSHD community were the top three. And then there was really very little, if nothing, in limb-girdle, oculopharyngeal, and the other. So those were kind of the leading things. And even back then, it was like Pfizer had committed, I think at one point, $250 million FSHD research, and then subsequently changed direction. But there were some really interesting early signals that, hey, we're finally going to get some of that. But the problem is they didn't have a mechanism of action. So the way the FSHD candidates are kind of in my mind is that there's kind of two different ways. There's one that's directly going after the mechanism of action, so the suppression of DUX4. There's those candidates. Then there's also the candidates that are working as an anti-inflammatory. That one of the things with that's thought about FSHD is that inflammation is a factor. So you have things, different things like interleukins going after them, and then some other products that maybe were not historically working, like the myostatins, but now they have longer half-lives, and there's some promise in some other wares. And then there's also folks directly going after the DUX4. So that I find that very appealing, because if you're going after the direct mechanism of action, it makes scientific sense that if you can suppress that you should have clinical benefit. Although, we know that from Alzheimer's disease, we know that suppressing beta amyloid occurred, but it did not show a clinical effect for people that had Alzheimer's disease. So, there's no holy grail, but it is very promising, and I've never been more excited in the FSHD world than now. I know that people have been in trials. My daughter and I formed the North Carolina chapter of the FSHD Society some years ago, and while I've not been as active in that chapter in the last several years, I was very active at the beginning. And the community asked me then, they said, could you give us just like a summary? Could you publish a summary on just, what FSHD is, kind of where we're at? I said, okay. So my daughter and I did that. We got together with a couple of physicians and we published a paper on that. Then they said, well, that's great, but what we really want is we want to know what the pipeline is. We want to know what the pipeline is, what the projections are, and that. So I said, okay. So we'll look at and that. And when you go out and write a paper back then, there was no AI tools and stuff. So it took like months and months. And then you have to get it published. So it takes another couple of months. So that took like a year. But we finally got that published. Went back to the North Carolina. I said, look, I got it for you guys. Here it is. And they're like, okay, well, it's also evolving. So I heard about this new product that you didn't mention in there. I said, oh, geez. So it is an evolving thing. So I can't like put my finger on one of them for you, but I can tell you that I have Communicated with several of the leaders in the companies that are working in FSHD. And of course, I keep in active contact with FSHD Society too. So, there's a lot of promising things out there, but I don't want to say one thing about one particular company over another. But I will tell you one thing that's kind of funny is that as a busy executive, I can't really read everything. I don't have enough time like most people. But I do read the Quest magazine from MDA, and that does have some interesting things in
Yeah.
there. It tells you about kind of in simple, plain language summaries. What is out there, where it's headed, and if you have an opportunity and you're considering going in a clinical trial. And then people ask me, they say, which clinical trial should I go in?
Yeah.
And I tell them this, I said, I can't tell you as a parent of two kids with FSHD or as a biopharmaceutical executive which trial to go into, but I can tell you the things I would look at, the positives and the negatives or even the unknowns, and then you can make up your own mind with yourself, your caregivers, and your whole team of specialists. So that can include your neurologist, include a physical therapist, it could include your friends and family, it can include anybody. But that whole team needs to come together and decide whether you want to go enroll in a clinical trial. But if you do, I think that there's two things. One is there's a benefit from knowing that you're advancing the science. And even if the trial doesn't work, like the one that I mentioned earlier that failed to show a difference from its comparator, you're still advancing the science. And that means we're getting one step closer to a disease-modifying treatment and hopefully one day a cure.
Right. I think it's everybody's personal choice if they want to be a participant in those things, clinical trial or even studies. I personally was involved with just one in University of Minnesota many years ago, and it felt like I was contributing, like what I could,
Yeah.
using your body for science, as they say.
Yeah.
Because if it's not me, then I thought, well, who else? And like getting muscle biopsies aren't fun, and I did like some cardio tests and stuff, which was okay back when I could actually run. And so it felt like I was at least doing my part, to kind of inject some type of help. So like, what kind of advice would you give like the listeners if for their part to help move the needle, so to speak, if they're contemplating it? I know you've mentioned, hey, get some advice from your circle, your community within, to tell you, hey, yeah, maybe you should try this, maybe you should try that. But there are still people that are kind of on the cusp. Do I
Sure.
really participate? Do I not? I'm not really sure. Or even participate in the community in general. So what would be your kind of like rah-rah speech, right?
Well,
Say, go get them.
from the pharmaceutical perspective, it's all it was all about data for a while. That if you had more data, that you could find more patients because they're rare by definition, right? FSHD is rare, so there's not that many people. We do know it's familial, so it does run in families, so we know that there's an element of that. Although we do also know that it's de novo, just a fancy word for knowing it spontaneously erupts, and we don't really know why. But from the pharmaceutical perspective, they're trying to find patients. But I tell the sponsors now, and it's evolving much better, that it's not just about finding patients, it's about giving them a compelling reason for being in a trial. And then the second thing is not just for enrolling in the trial and providing someone with a convincing reason, but it's to stay in the trial. So let's say, for example, years ago, they would have something where a readout wouldn't happen for a year because they know that FSHD, like a lot of diseases, it's slow and they didn't have the natural history. They didn't know, they couldn't predict exactly where each person is going to go because phenotypically, meaning just how it presents itself to the outside world, can be different in different families. I mean, it's different between my daughter and my own son, and it's in the same family. I've seen it in twins, in FSHD twins, where one progresses fast and one seems clinically normal. So, how do you figure that? So, there are some unknowns we don't know. But one of the things is that we know that the pharmaceutical company needs to keep them in too, because then you get missing data. So, you want to keep people in. So, one thing they did is for like a year-long study, they would have an interim look in the middle of the study, say it's 6 months, so that you didn't have to do that. Sometimes the regulators, like the FDA or somebody, would say something like, well, you need to do it. You need to compare this drug to a placebo so we can see that if nothing happens. And a lot of people say to themselves, well, geez, I don't want to be in a placebo trial. So what they might do is say, well, rather than have a one-to-one randomization, you could make a one-to-two or a one-to-three randomization. That way, you only had a third of a chance of getting in that. Or another way that a lot of companies are trying to get around so that they can satisfy the regulators but also satisfy the patients that want to enroll is they'll say, look, we're going to have you in the placebo-controlled study, but we'll give everybody the drug, meaning if you're on placebo, you'll get the drug after our endpoint reads out in what they call an open label form, so you can actually get the product at the end. And that's really nice because then at least you know you're going to get the drug eventually. So even if you get randomized into the trial, and hopefully it's just random, like you have the same chance as someone else is either getting in or not getting in, then you know that at least you'll get the product at the end. So that way, if it's working, at least you'll have earlier access than you would if you have to wait till approval, which sometimes can take 6 months, a year, or even longer, as the regulators go through the information and digest it and make a decision on whether it's of benefit to society and whether it fulfills the efficacy and safety criteria that is needed by the FDA in order to put a stamp of approval.
What's the biggest difference then? You talk about the FDA, a lot of, within the states, but do you also deal with Europe and like how they go through the process of trials and so forth?
Yeah, so actually, the company I work for now, Sciences, is actually headquartered in London. And my primary role is to serve as an American bridge for sponsors of American companies that have a rare disease products and then market them in Europe. So we work in all of the European Union as well as some of the non-European Union that might come to mind, like Switzerland or England now is, post-Brexit is now not part of the EU, and some other countries. So we can actually market it everywhere there. And I thought it was a little interesting when I was a member of the STRIDE community, and I can't remember the exact acronym now for that, but it was a statewide initiative in order to help companies, states, I'm sorry, in the United States, because there's differences on cell and gene therapies. And the message was for that program was that cell and gene therapies are coming, and they're coming like a freight train. So like for 20 years ago, when I worked in cell and gene therapies, I worked in the investment world. If you had to use two words to describe cell and gene therapies, it would have been high risk because they mostly didn't work. But in the last probably 2 years, we've seen 90% of all the cell and gene therapies been approved because almost all of them were. In fact, for years, it was only Zolgensma for spinal muscular atrophy and Luxturna, and they were always referenced. And now, like, I don't even have them all memorized because there's so many. And my daughter and I talked 20 years ago. Do you think there'll ever be a CRISPR approved? I said, it's going to be some time. This was 20 years ago. I said, it's going to be some time, but it's very promising. And they just had their last CRISPR approved two Decembers ago. So CRISPR's coming too.
And those that don't know what exactly what CRISPR is, can you like describe
Yeah,
that?
I can't remember the exact words for the technology either, but the way I describe it is that it's a tool that can act almost like a scissors to kind of cut DNA and RNA structures and put it in a certain sequence to make it either better or skip things or to make it put together in a certain way that works better for the human or to make the right protein or a form of the protein.
Yeah, and it sounds very sci-fi, right? Going in, cutting your DNA, and then people get worried, like, what is that gonna, affect other parts of that person, and so to speak. But have you seen anything that's coming along the pipeline in the research that feels sci-fi, but yet it's got a lot of promise? Is it the CRISPR? Is it something else?
So the cell and gene therapies are really interesting because I think to the average person, when they hear that, they think cure. And even though the ones that have been approved so far have not really been a cure or not shown yet to be a cure or 100% durable, lasting forever or whatever, there has been some pretty transformative products like the Zolgensma and others. So you have to be a little careful with that. And the other thing about cell and gene therapies is I have talked to many patients. And many patients do say, look, it was studied in a clinical trial maybe 3, 4 years or something, but I want to know what the long-term effect is if you're going to permanently alter my RNA or DNA. So they may be like, let's just see how it kind of goes and then I'll take it. Or, hey, my therapy actually right now, while it's not great, at least I'm controlled and I'm not sure what this is going to have. Or they may add something onto it. Like the thing about cell and gene therapies that has the community kind of a little anxious is that it's kind of like ACC basketball here in the Southeast United States, where I'm from. It's called one and done. And the phenomenon one and done in cell and gene therapies is you can only take one currently now and you can't be in another trial. So it's not like you can just jump around. And part of the reason is because like with the adeno-associated virus, the AAV vector, which is pretty popular, and several gene therapies have been approved using that technology. It basically is, in kind of a simplistic terms, it's like a cold virus, but it's been a little bit inactivated. So it shouldn't pose that big of a problem to any person. But the problem is your body will try to fight these. So it develops antibodies to them. So if you tried to get another one, it basically would gobble up the whole protein because your body's immune system, if it's working properly, would just gobble it up and it wouldn't work. So it's not just a matter of trying to be regulating on people. There's a scientific validity for why you couldn't take another one. But it also makes it for the first time, like in the Duchenne community, where there was only one maybe cell and gene therapy option for that. It was either you go in there or you don't. So the same with FSHD, when one comes out, it's either you go in or you don't. That's it. But then when in the Duchenne community they had more than one, then people said, which one should I go in? Well, again, that's a difficult thing, because once you go in one, you can't go in another one. So how do you strategize? Do you wait until you're a little older? Maybe you progress, or do you go earlier? Maybe when your muscles aren't as deteriorated. There's all those things that have to go through your mind when you make that. And the only way you can, I think, make the best decision is to talk to the scientists around you, and that's your neurologist and your caregivers and your team. And some of these FSHD teams, like my kids, they may be 7 or 8 or 9 people that are caring for them, and they run for the gamut from occupational therapists, physical therapists, potentially psychiatrists or psychologists, neurologists, respiratory therapists, so there's a whole team involved, and I would get everybody's input if I was making a decision like that and I only had one chance at it.
Yeah, be educated, right? Get as
Yeah,
much data as you
absolutely.
can so you know what direction you're going, especially if it's a one and done, as you say. I appreciate the sports reference, by the way. But yeah, the it is it's a scary thing to think about attacking a rare disease. There's also, though, a part of it that can be a little bit inspiring. You feel to be more that you have energy to be inspired to help attack this disease. Ultimately, like, I know family is kind of what drew you in, but there's a lot of, family members that have loved ones with FSHD, but they're not doing what you do. They're not jumping that far in. Why, what do you think is ultimately the driver for you? Because I mean, you've been doing this for a long time and you know so much, the information you've gathered.
So from me, I know that I'm personally have had a pretty easy life. So I see what people struggle with FSHD, and I see the progression of it, and it doesn't match the original expectations I've heard. So I've taken on as a personal mandate, me and my entire family have taken on as a mandate to try to help others with this. And it not only helps them, but it also helps ourselves. So it's kind of, one of my coping strategies. So, there's a couple of ways you could go when you have some bad news in life, and we all are familiar with some of the negative ways you could go. I'm trying to turn it into the most positive I possibly can. And while there are days where I have to admit I do get depressed, or I don't like the way things are going, and I'm not happy because I'm in the emergency room with one of my kids. For the most part, we've tried to deal with this the best we can, and I think by helping others is the best way we can help ourselves. So I don't know how that exactly works. I would love to tell you. I'm a psychiatrist and I can tell you how it works, but I don't. But it drives me, and I get up every day thinking, how can I provide more products to more people? And whether you live in Italy or you live in the UK, or whether you live in Kansas City or you live out in Seattle, Washington, each of those kids that has FSHD is just as important to me.
You bring up a couple of key points there. One, the mental health side of this disease. And then, of course, trying to have as much inclusiveness to it, as well. So the mental health side, we've had other guests on the program too, where I've asked them, it could be a caregiver I ask or someone with the disease, like, what's more difficult to manage of this disease, the physical aspect or the emotional mental health side? What would you say from your perspective?
So I started a Persons with Disabilities employee resource group at one of the large companies I worked for in a previous life, and not that so long ago. And I learned that, 1 in 10 people in the United States has a rare disease. So it's actually collectively they're fairly common. So FSHD falls in that category. About 1 in 4 has a disability. And while it's easy to see a person in a wheelchair, like my two kids, they use a wheelchair. It doesn't, you don't have to have a PhD level training to see somebody in a wheelchair and know they have a visible disability. But what is really hard is the invisible disabilities. And unfortunately, that's the majority of disabilities. Some people have said it's north of 70% of all disabilities are invisible. So unless someone self-discloses sometimes, there are some times you can see somebody and know that something's not quite right. And you may not be a psychiatrist, but you know that. But a lot of times it's invisible. And I mean, it's completely invisible. Unless someone discloses it to you, you're not going to know. And we have to be respectful for that, because there are places in society, of course, in America, where it may be used against you, say in the insurance area or something like that. So people ask me, should I disclose that I have FSHD? What do you think? And I said, well, that's a decision you have to make, because once it's put out there, it could be used against you. I've seen several couples that get married that will not disclose that they have it until after they get insurance for their spouse or something like that. So there are ways that, and there are certain things, you have to be truthful in life. So if someone asks you a certain thing, and you can't lie, but on the other hand, you don't always have to be forthcoming. And HIPAA rules do protect us to some degree in the United States. So, you have to be cognizant that there are privacy laws protecting you. But it is difficult to know whether to disclose or not disclose. And there's a stigma associated with having a rare disease. So some people find it very difficult to master that, and they feel isolated because a lot of people that, especially FSHD, that can't ambulate well, may spend more time at home than they do outside. And all of us are all differently. Some people like to be around people a lot, and some people, not as much. And but I think COVID was very isolating, and from a lot of people I learned, it took a toll on people's mental health, especially in the FSHD society group. So I think we need to be cognizant, and I think we need to be a little more open about talking about mental health because, in general, I think it's still stigmatized in the United States, and it's something that should not be swept under the rug. Because I've seen even friends of mine, and I'm a little older, so I have combat veteran friends, and I also have other caregivers. And whether you call it post-traumatic stress disorder or chronic traumatic stress disorder, caregivers can take a it can take a toll on caregivers as well. So we need to be cognizant if you're caring for someone that you need to take care of yourself for the primary remit that you have to take care of the ones that you love.
Yeah, the sense in this country, the stigma, as you brought it up, the first thing when I heard you say that is like mental illness equals weakness. You know,
That's
that's
what a lot
always
of
seemed
people
to be the,
perceive.
yeah,
Yeah. And
exactly.
I think the problem is that it used to be perceived as asking for help as a sign of weakness as well. And I look at actually asking for help as a sign of strength, because when I ask for help from my teammates, even at my work where I am now, and I've only been there less than 6 months, the people that I've interacted and collaborated with, while it takes more time and sometimes can be more difficult, the fruits of that, whether it be a white paper or some thought leadership or a webinar, are much better from getting the insights from multiple people than just for one. So isolation is definitely not the answer, and I think we definitely need to do that. I think also having mental health, there's some things about Zoom and Teams that I love, but there's also something about being face to face. And now almost it seems like every interaction I have to ask somebody, is it okay if I hug you, or is it okay if I shake your hand? Because I'm not sure if it's, you have to be careful, because there's certain places where you can and certain places where you can't, and you have to be cognizant of that. But being cognizant of that, I was at the World Orphan Drug Congress, and I was asking a lot of people who I hadn't seen or hadn't talked to for a while, or some people I've never met, but I highly respect, asking them if I could hug them or give them a handshake, because there's
Yeah.
something about interaction like that for humans that I think we need.
Yeah. I think you hit that spot on. Some people get uncomfortable with it. The fact you have to ask back
Right.
in the day, like you
That's
did,
okay.
you held your hand out and that's just how it was. Now with things are a little bit different. And yeah, you're right. It is okay. The fact though that we still, I think, still need the interaction as humans. I would love to have more of these interviews. I'm not gonna lie, like in studio and have people here and all that kind of stuff. I've had those in a past life podcast, and they're always a lot of fun where you can interact with the person when they're there. There's just more of a connection. And I think that's like the key is that connectability. It's the fact that you can share something that you have in common with someone, if it's the fight against this rare disease, or you have it, or you know someone that has it. It's all that commonality that seems to kind of glue everybody together. I've had conversations with people that have never met someone with FSHD up until maybe they met me. And then they're like, wow, you know, it's like this sense or feeling that they didn't think was going to come with it. And it is like a kinship, a brotherhood type feel. Family, you know, maybe I guess is an okay word to use. Not everybody likes their family, so I always get a little bit leery of using that term. But
It's
you know,
certainly a
more like your
kinship. I
tribe.
mean,
Yes,
yeah.
yeah, absolutely. And I think that that's really important. So along those lines that of like kinship, I also then think of, you know, keeping everybody in mind, meaning, you know, age, gender, you know, sex, etc. And you talked about, you know, people that have a visible, you know, in a wheelchair, etc. Okay, you can see they have a disability. So the whole DEI, political now been a little bit on the forefront, you know, even stores starting to like remove some of the regulations or whatever that they had in place. Not going to name them. We all know we've kind of seen these things being passed along across social media and the internet and so forth and stories. But what does that really equal within our realm of like disease, rare disease?
I think it means for rare diseases and for patients and their caregivers, I think it means that we need to be intentional about things, because every person's important, and it doesn't matter. So some of those statuses or things that should be protected, like the gender, like you mentioned, or the ambulatory status, may not be, but you know, certain other things, like typically when I used to think of DE&I, I used to think of just ethnicity. And look, I lived in West Africa as a minority, which is something not a lot of white people can say. And but I always knew I was going home, so I really was never I never felt that I was kind of locked there, or that I was the same, or that I could, because I had all these unique insights. But I did it did make me think a little bit differently, and it did make me a little more inclusive, because I realized too that socioeconomic factors can really be a big difference. You know, for people going into clinical trial, most of the people I know that have FSHD can't work full-time jobs, or maybe only work a part-time job, or they work on a non-salary job, so that if they have to take away time from work in order to go to a clinical trial, that may be their biggest impetus for not going in. They may be all in otherwise, but if they take a couple days off, they're going to lose some money, so they can't go in. Whereas me, I've been blessed for many years to be on a salary, so it's not that big a deal if I take an hour off here or an hour off there, because I still get paid the same. So we have to be a little more, we have to look at where people are coming from. And also the people that can't, we need to make sure that, that the people that are in the clinical trials look like the people that are going to be sold that products. So when we look to the United States, we have to look at the ethnicity of what the United States looks like, and make sure that we represent people from all the groups that represent what the United States is today. And if you're looking at the clinical trial participants and they don't look like that, then that to me that's a cause for change. So there are a lot of groups out there that, despite regulations or talk, are still intentional about doing that. But I think if we're not intentional, then we'll revert to the status quo, and we can't go there.
Correct. Yeah, we cannot. And if it just feels like the door is opened a little bit, even if it's a crack or wide open, I'm not sure that it almost feels like, I mean, is it going to be okay to have like places of employment, you know, shoo you away because you have a disability? I mean, is do you feel like that's the direction this is going backwards?
That's why I was a fan. I tell people the story, how I started the Person with the Disability group, is there were some other groups that were starting employee resource groups. One was a Black ERG, which was a leader in that regard at the company where I started the Person with Disabilities ERG. And I looked to them and I saw a lot of good things from there. And I said, and someone had asked me, as the head of the Rare Disease Consortium at the time, why would it be important to do this? And I said, well, it's not only important for them, but there's other communities like the rare disease community, where a lot of people are disabled, either visibly or invisibly, or both. And they need to be kind of have a voice for them as well, and make sure that we're making changes to make sure that it's inclusive for them. And I'll be honest with you, most of the things that people with disabilities ask for were very low or no cost. And there was a lot of changes that were made. And one of the things is, I think, is you need to put yourself in another person's shoes. So, like, you know, to kind of see where they're coming from. And I think one of the things we did that was really helpful was we had a thing where upper management agreed to be in a wheelchair for 4 hours in a day. And we had several presidents do that. And I'll tell you, they couldn't reach for stuff and find things. So all of a sudden it kind of opened their eyes that, hey, we can do better. And a lot of this stuff doesn't have to cost money. So I think people are always worried that to try to accommodate people with disabilities is going to be a huge drain on everything. And I think there's a lot of data coming out now that points to the contrary, that actually it's caused very little data, and you can be a lot more inclusive than you are now, or a lot more supportive or even accommodating, legally and as well as ethically. And I also think too that, you know, now that jobs are hard to come by, especially certain jobs, it's hyper competitive, and you want to be working in for a company that has a culture that I think supports that. Otherwise, if you have a company that does not support those things, then I think people are going to be less attracted to go to that company.
Yeah, I agree. Even all the way down to the retail level, right? Where people even like avoid going to certain companies if they believe that their business morality, so to speak, doesn't line up with their own. And then they
Exactly.
make those decisions. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just an interesting state that we're kind of in at this point. And it just became more to the forefront. And like as you mentioned, I think people think DEI meaning more sexual orientation or gender or whatnot or race, but there's also the disability side of it. Like that group of people is going to be affected by this too. So we got just a couple more questions I wanted to ask. And one, you know, being the person or in the position that you're in, I guess, what would you say then looks like the future? You kind of talked about it, like in 5 years, maybe there's a treatment or something. From your vantage point, What is the positive? What could be changed in a positive way in the next, let's say, 5 years from now in regards to FSHD?
Yeah, so a couple of things I think would give you hope if you're listening to this podcast would be that there are some high wealth people. One lives in Canada who's donating a lot of money, and then there's also companies that are just started. I talked to a CEO in the last month and a half who just raised north of $80 million to start a new FSHD candidate therapy, and she assured me that she'll do everything she can to make sure that product gets to market, and I 100% believe her. There are a lot of companies out there that I've had the privilege of talking to several of their employees, so I know them more. And that's the only reason I'm mentioning their names is because I've met employees from, say, like Avidity or Dyne or Fulcrum or some of these, and I've met their teams and talked to some of their team members, and they're highly committed. There's a lot of people out there that are trying. So, first realize that you're not alone. Next thing realize is there's a lot of people out there that are really working hard to try to get these products across and the line, and realize that. This is not an easy thing. So, we all have to kind of work together. And that's why I applaud groups like the FSHD Society who are trying to raise as much money as they can to determine things like natural history. And they're not, if you watch the FSHD Society at all, they are not just US centric. They are trying very hard to work with Europeans and all over the globe. They reach out to the other groups like Solve FSHD or, the different FSHD communities. And I see that is very encouraging. I've seen the same thing happen in the DMD community, which led to several of their approvals, and I'm starting to see that same rallying cry in the FSHD communities. I also recommend if you are not a member of the FSHD Society or not a member of a private Facebook chat room to get involved and try to learn more about the education to educate yourself, because my other advice to you would be that you will know more than the physicians, and you will need to have an elevator pitch to make sure you get the health care that you need and you deserve in the United States. So you do need to understand about your disease. Unfortunately, that's something you'll have to take with you. My kids have had to learn that. And I'll tell you what, it's actually kind of hard to stick up for yourself. I learned that over the years that, but unfortunately, I think you have to do that too. So I see products that are failing and they're moving the science ahead, but also see products that are in the pipeline that have a lot of promise, and not just ones that are going to treat the inflammatory side or the that which might make you feel better. Because when I was at, I had the privilege of going to one of the patient or the patient focused drug development meeting some years back during COVID. I don't know if you watched that, Tim, or had somebody on for there, but my daughter talked as a patient. I talked as a caregiver to the FDA and provided them feedback. And one of the things was, is of course, everybody wants a cure, but they say if you couldn't get a cure, even if you could cut my fatigue by half, or even if you could do, this or that, other things. So I think it's important to understand that even if we don't get a cure for FSHD, but if you could cut the fatigue in half, or you could work longer hours, or you could go from 20 to 30 hours where you can now get benefits even though you're not working a full time, or you could work a full time job because before you can only work 30 hours, that's a huge progressive step in someone's life and can make a huge difference. I know that we're trying to find endpoints and things too, like the reachable space was a big thing in the FSHD community because, even my own kids can't really lift their arms that well. And you can tell the progression when you start to use like a second hand to bolster your first hand in order to eat and things like that. You can tell that there's some progression going on. And experts are working very hard towards biomarkers, and they're working towards things that can predict clinical benefit. So like measuring the DUX protein is not an easy thing in blood, but they're trying to make correlations with certain things so they can see that if they change something clinically, I mean, if they change something molecularly or change something you can measure in the blood, that will have a clinical benefit. So there's a lot of shots on goal right now. And I think it's like any kind of basketball game. As long as we keep having more and more shots, one of them's going to go in.
Yeah, agree 100%, 100%. And it sounds like there's more and more shots happening more and more, which is equals hope, as you kind of started that part of it, that key word. It can be dangerous to have hope because it can get crushed, right? You're putting it on the line a little bit emotionally, but we need it in order to keep moving forward in a positive direction. Which kind of leads me then to the last question I definitely wanted to ask, because you're a parent, okay, and that's like number one probably in your life. It sounds like that actually is probably the driver of where you are and what you're doing, even as a profession. So there are, I'm sure, young parents out there, or I should say young meaning young to this process. Maybe their child was recently diagnosed with FSHD and they're not quite sure what the first steps forward are, probably in freak out mode, as I can imagine, and not sure where to turn. So from a parent, perspective and now knowing what you know now, what advice would you give those parents?
One thing I tell them is that you're in a better place now than I was 20 years ago, because there wasn't a molecular diagnosis that was able. Now there is. So you can have a more accurate diagnosis. We have lots of shots on goal, and there's a lot of people out there, and there's money flowing, hundreds of millions into the FSHD clinical drug development schema, meaning, you know, all the different people, if you add them all together.
Yeah.
But you need to reach out to an advocacy group that is kind of unbiased. So the first place I would go would be a place like the FSHD Society or a place like that. The other thing too is you need to realize you're not alone, and that there's a lot of other community members that have gone through what you're going through and have developed some techniques in order to get through it in an easier fashion than just doing it de novo, which it seems like we all have to kind of do it ourselves. And then it's like, wow, I wish I would have known that.
Right.
It's almost like the parenting manual, though. I can't tell another person how to parent. I can't tell another person like what to do for their kid. But, you know, on one hand, but on the other hand, I can give them some tips and tricks that have helped us when we saw certain things. So get together with those private Facebook chat communities. If you want to reach out to me on LinkedIn, I never say no to another parent. So, if, you know, I help you however I can. I've done some thought leadership. I even wrote a chapter on FSHD that has a summary of kind of things that we talked about here today. If you're interested to learn more about the science and want to know some of the more granular details, and they can certainly reach out to me. But I think the FSHD Society now, I used to know every person, and I knew all about their background and their families. And I'll be honest with you, with all the new hires there, there's a few folks I still don't know, like everybody there. You know, I know a lot of them, but I don't know everyone. But reach out to them, because they've grown a lot and they're doing a lot of good things, and they have a lot of stuff that they didn't have before. So they have sessions you can go to learn about things. And I would take advantage of them, because I did. I've actually contributed to some, and I've listened to some, and they're all very helpful, I think. So, you know, definitely get involved with that. And look, today we're on the internet today. So there's no reason why a mom in Slovakia or a mother in Ireland can't help you in the United States as well. And I talk to people all the time from all overseas, including even in China, that are trying to fight FSHD. So, you know, you're not alone. There's a lot of people out there, and we're getting closer and closer. So I really think that we're getting razor thin close now to seeing that. And I'll be honest with you, that was one of my prayers, that I get to see that in my lifetime, to see a, you know, product for my kids.
Yeah. Beautiful. Great advice. Love it. So much information that you gave us today. Ray, it was just phenomenal, phenomenal. You are a just ocean of knowledge, in my opinion. So thank you for bringing so much to the forefront for us, kind of showing your perspective, all the hard work you're doing. It feels like, at least I hope, that we didn't miss anything. We can always have you back on. I'd love to do that in the future for sure. Maybe even have your daughter back on too. Maybe I can convince her to do that as well.
And her husband.
Yes. Have them both on, right? Like, this is going to be a relationships podcast episode, maybe. That'd be fun. Yeah. So thanks, Ray, for joining us. You take care.
Well, thank you too, Tim. Appreciated the opportunity.
Absolutely. So that is Ray Hummel. He's joined us today and was amazing guest. I mean, it's just so much knowledge that this gentleman has been within the family, FSHD attacking, certain family members. And what does he do? He takes that energy and he says, let's see if I can do something about it. And not that everybody has to go to that extreme or that extent, per se, and everybody has to come to it in their own time. And we've talked about that before, but you know, he talked about the hope of what's coming. He's talked about where FSHD is from 20 years ago to where it is now. Great advice for parents. I had to touch on that. The DEI issue for me is a massive issue for those that, you know, need to have employment or anything for that matter, that this is going to affect your life, and you can't be discriminated against. We have to make sure that doesn't happen, and that the people that are in the particular powers of government especially realize that there's a lot of people in our community that need to be represented, that they can't be left out. They need to make a living. They need to, you know, have the same affordances that anybody else has, even able-bodied people. So I wanted to make sure we touched on that with him. And of course, the drug development is like a key thing. The work that Ray Hummel is doing is phenomenal. He's been within the science of this for so long, really has dug deep into it. Census, I believe, or Sciences is the pronunciation of the place he works now. And currently, yes, you can follow him on LinkedIn if you want to find him there. He's very approachable. Send him a direct if you'd like. that's how you kind of get in touch with him. Just a great guest today, and a great source of knowledge, as you can clearly see and hear. If you want to get in touch with me, email me, please, fshdradio@fshdsociety.org. That's actually how Ray Hummel did it as well. He emailed me and talked about possibly being a guest on the show. He had a lot of topics he wanted to cover. I agreed. There was a lot of things to unpack. I will definitely have him on again, especially as our disease progression, or cure, I should say, hopefully treatment comes down the pipeline closer. I want to get more of his input on those things as they come about. I think he has a lot of hope to share with us to where we are now. But I want to hear from you. What are the things you want to talk about? What are the things that maybe we haven't talked about that you think we should? What kind of guests would you like on? Maybe you want to be a guest. Feel free to reach out, fshdradio@fshdsociety.org. This podcast, of course, supported by the FSHD Society. I have so much support within the office. Aaron and Ann, who do a lot of the editing and helping get guests and so forth. Always want to say thank you to them and everybody else that is involved with the podcast. It's been always a lot of fun bringing the episodes to you, and I look forward to bringing you the next one down the line. So don't forget, share the show like crazy, even outside of the FSHD community. I think this and these stories can be impactful for many that deal with certain things in their life. Hopefully it's a positive source for them, or inspiration perhaps, as I help bring these guests in to share their life, their stories with FSHD. And I think it can directly help those that don't even have this disease per se, but their story of overcoming can be very, very helpful for those that have to do that, in especially in regards to, you know, mental illness and those topics that can be tough to talk about. But we bring them up because I think everyone is battling that. Everybody has a something. If you share this episode, or if you share other episodes, share the podcast, there's got to be somebody out there that has their something that hopefully maybe this will help them. And that really is the key point. So thanks again for being here, listening to another episode of FSHD Straight Talk. I've been your host, Tim Hollenbeck. Take care. We'll see you next time.